Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. There have been a lot of highs and a lot of lows in Wayne Kramer's life, and he spends time on both in his raw new autobiography, The Hard Stuff, Dope, Crime, the MC5, and My Life of Impossibilities. The founder of the short-lived but influential rock group the MC5 is one of Rolling Stone's 100 Greatest Guitarists. He's released several solo albums and worked on scores for films and TV. He's also battled addiction, served time in federal prison for selling drugs, and created the nonprofit Jail Guitar Doors USA, which works to help inmates write and express themselves through music. This fall, Kramer is teaming up with an all-star group of musicians for the MC50 tour, which naturally ends in Detroit in October. Wayne Kramer, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks, Ian. Happy to be here.
How have rehearsals for the tour been going so far?
Really fun. Really productive. The guys are such accomplished musicians that the MC5 never sounded this good.
How did you go about deciding who you would play with for this particular tour?
My first goal was that they be good brothers, that they be good genial traveling companions and co-workers. You know, touring looks like fun from the outside, but inside it's grueling. We were going to be working six nights a week, and you never quite get enough sleep, and the food is not great, and everything's done in motion. So I wanted to have people that were seasoned veterans that knew how to tour, that had good attitudes and good spirits about them.
So you mentioned a moment ago that the MC5 never sounded that good, and you write a lot about that in the book about why, you know, there were struggles in the studio, and when you did that first album, the live album, that it was difficult to capture the essence of the group. When you look back on those days, do you feel that the group did not reach its potential on recordings?
No, and it wasn't difficult to capture the group's live performance. We just didn't do it. If we had recorded a different night, we would have gotten a good one. The band was mercurial in that we might play four or five shows that were magnificent, and then we'd play a stinker. So you know, it wasn't that hard, and it got better as we learned more about how to work in the recording studio.
For this particular tour, have you had to learn stuff that you haven't played in, you know, 50 years in some cases?
Yeah. I have, and it's been an illuminating experience. I didn't really know if it was going to work, so we did some summer festivals in Europe this year, and I was happy to learn that after the second song we had won the crowds over, and that they understood perfectly what it was that we were doing. You know, that we were bringing the hard rock. Balls to the wall, and, you know, and they got it.
So you're just about the exact right age to have come up with the first, you know, great rock and roll acts. You were very influenced by Chuck Berry, as you write about. And when you did establish the band, what were you going for in the early days of the MC5?
It was a total assault on the culture. We wanted to just blow people out of their everyday experience and provide them with a dance concert experience that would resensitize them and recharge them to go out in the world and make a difference and make a difference in their own lives, make a difference in their families, make a difference in their communities, make a difference in the whole world. We were shooting very high.
What was the scene like in Detroit at that time?
Very exciting. Lots and lots of great bands. The MC5 was the house band at a venue called the Grandy Ballroom. And this was an old 1930s style big band ballroom that was perfectly set up for the Electric Band dance concert. It had a huge dance, floating wooden dance floor that you could fit 3,000 people in, beautifully appointed, and so there was a place to perform, and it was a very exciting time. There was a lot happening, you know, and the Detroit audience was very plugged into the world around them. I mean, this is the period in our history where Robert Kennedy had been assassinated. Of course, his older brother, JFK, was assassinated a few years earlier. Malcolm X was assassinated. Martin Luther King was murdered. And the war in Vietnam was going on, and the police departments in cities around the country were highly oppressive to communities of color. So there was a lot of energy in the air. Nobody really knew what might happen next, if the whole thing was going to come unhinged.
Was involving the band in political movements and so on, being a very politically aware group, was that a conscious decision that you all made at the time?
No, I don't think it was conscious. I think it happened naturally and organically. I mean, we didn't wake up one day and say, hey, let's be political. We just grew up in a culture that ultimately radicalized us, and we were part of a generation that was in agreement that the older generation was making a complete mess of the world, that they were polluting the planet, that they were oppressing people of color, that, you know, things like marijuana should not be illegal, this war that was going on in Vietnam was illegal and immoral and unjustified. And so, you know, we were part of a whole generation. But the difference between the MC5 and other bands of the period was that we addressed the audience's concerns directly. We spoke directly to their concerns about the war or the draft or civil rights or marijuana laws. We didn't beat around the bush about it.
So the question naturally follows, what do you make of what you're seeing today in politics compared to that era?
Well, it's different in fundamental ways. I don't believe there is an agreement across a generation today about what direction we're moving in or what can be done. Although I see signs of an emerging youth class of political activism and people of good conscience becoming more involved. But there are disturbing parallels. I mean, we have, again, we have a wretched grifter in the White House who has utter contempt for the rule of law and sees the presidency as his personal fiefdom, as a business opportunity. And the corruption from the highest offices of power down to local city councils and, you know, the local dog catcher. The corruption is stunning in the quantity and quality of the wrongdoing. It's just unbelievable. So those things are not dissimilar. The fact that there's a war going on the other side of the world for 17 years now in the Middle East and Afghanistan, with a country that actually poses no threat to the United States of America. This is exactly what Dwight D. Eisenhower warned the American people about when he left office, that there's a thing called the military-industrial complex. And when you get politicians and arms manufacturers and generals all together, they will find a way to create perpetual war. And today, you know, there is no draft, so nobody has to pay the cost except those families that are going over there to fight in the war. Generally, military families, people whose parents were soldiers and grandparents were soldiers. And there's also the reason that young men will always go off to war, because this is an ancient rite of passage to see if they can stand in the fire and can they survive it. I used to think it had something to do with politics. It doesn't. So that's a parallel. There are parallels in American drug policy, in that in the 60s we locked people up for marijuana, and today that resulted in hyper-incarceration with drug crimes in general. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. We have 2.3 million people in prison in America. It's an international embarrassment, and it's a national disgrace. I think it's the greatest failure of social policy in America's domestic history. So there are some parallels, but these are all things that we can repair these things. We can move forward on these things. Remember, people created these messes, and if people created it, people can fix it.
We're speaking with Wayne Kramer, and his new memoir is The Hard Stuff. You just mentioned mass incarceration, and that was an issue that you were interested in reforming before you had your own struggles and went to prison yourself. I'm wondering, when that happened in the mid to late 70s, how did that change your attitude, if at all, about, you know, what American life behind bars was like?
Serving a prison term in America is a life-changing experience. Not really much can prepare you for that. If you've served a sentence, you'll know what I'm talking about. You are never safe. You are forced to live with very dangerous people. Those big, strong prison guards aren't there to protect you. They're protecting each other, and they really don't care about you. It's embarrassing. It's dehumanizing. It's emasculating. And some people might say, good, that's what prisons are for. And I understand that. I understand the sense that people share about fairness, that if you do something wrong, that you should be held accountable. I get that. But in America, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. When you lock people up for decades for nonviolent drug offenses, that's not justice. When you lock people up for decades for minor property crimes, that's not justice. And then you ignore white-collar crime that steals people's pensions, their hard-earned savings, that subvert government, and they don't go to prison, that is not justice either. So the hypocrisy is infuriating for me. And after living in prison for a couple of years and understanding what that meant, I determined that I had to do something to try to mitigate the damage.
Yeah, tell us about that, because your work within prisons, and you've worked with Billy Bragg, getting instruments in there, getting inmates playing music and so on. How did that begin?
Well, it began with the understanding that of the 2.3 million of our fellow citizens that are in prison, 90% of them are going to come home. And we release 600,000 prisoners a year back into the community in America. And if we don't do something to help them change for the better while they're in custody, they will most certainly change for the worse. And to ignore this, we ignore this at our own peril. These are the same people that we're going to be standing in line next to at the supermarket and sitting next to at the movies and taking our kids to school. These are human beings who are going to return to the community. And So what I tried to figure out, what could I do? Well, I'm a musician. I was a musician in prison. I know that there are musicians in prison today and creative people in prison. Maybe I could be the bridge between these two communities. And I launched Jail Guitar Doors just about 10 years ago with Billy Bragg and my wife, Margaret Kramer. And what we do is simple. We find people that work in corrections that are willing to use music as a tool for rehabilitation. We provide them with instruments. We don't gift them musical instruments. The instruments represent a challenge. If they accept our donation of instruments, then they've accepted the challenge to use these as tools to find a better way to express uncomfortable and complex emotions. We today have our instruments in over 120 American prisons, and we run songwriting workshop programs in prisons across the country and jails across the country. We're in the LA County Jail, the Cook County Jail in Chicago, Rikers Island in New York, in the Massachusetts Youth Offender System, in Detroit, and on 10 California adult prison yards from medium to maximum security facilities. And we've developed a criteria, a curriculum, to work with people in prison to help them find a way through songwriting to tell their story. We all have a story, and we all want our story heard. And if a man or a woman or a child tells their story in a song, it becomes a positive way to talk about something that was not positive. It adds some beauty to the world. It adds art to the world. And for the first time, they can begin to see themselves as more than just their crime, or just a prison number or a bed space. And they can start to see themselves returning to the community and having something to offer. It's not the end all and be all, but it is the beginning of the long, hard work of rehabilitation and positive change.
You became a father at age 65, I believe.
Yep.
How did that change you?
The same way it changes everybody else that has kids. You know, I am admittedly self-centered and selfish and self-seeking. Artists and musicians suffer from this mental disorder. But when a child enters your life, you have to stop thinking about yourself and think about that new person that is living in your house. And this was a great gift that I could focus on what would be best for him and work hard to provide the best for him, listen, if I don't do this right, if I don't do my job and have food on the table, this kid will starve to death.
No pressure.
sometimes it's that simple, and that's enough. You know, it's the most important thing I've ever done, and the most valuable thing I've ever done, and the coolest thing I've ever done.
Is he musical?
He's at this stage. He's 5 years old. He's everything. He's an athlete. He's a dancer. He's a singer. He's a musician. He's a poet. You know, he is in love with life.
I have to ask about Kick Out the Jams. I think you said you wrote it hanging out in the kitchen. How did you come up with the riff?
Sitting there playing the guitar, playing things that I thought sounded good. I was just running through a handful of different new riffs that I had come up with, and Tyner heard one, and he said, "Wait a minute, play that one again." And I said, okay, and I started playing. He said, wait a minute, I have a lyric that'll fit pretty good on that. And that's how a lot of songs are born. You just noodling away on the guitar, just seeing what sounds good with, you know, if you mix this up with that, you try this chord against that chord, or this rhythmic figure against that rhythmic figure. And sometimes you hear things, you think, well, that isn't too bad. That sounds kind of good. And that sometimes is all you need. That's the portal that opens the door for you to go in there and get the song.
And it's been covered by everybody. Do you have a favorite version?
Actually, I do. There's a version by an Australian band called Deep Street Soul. And they pulled the sheet off the MC5. They understood that the MC5 was actually a soul band with guitars instead of horns. And they recorded it with a funky beat and a wonderful black woman singing the tune and a Hammond organ. And it's very funky and very hard rocking. And it's got a little horn section on it. It's just terrific. It's my favorite version.
Okay, so we'll hear the MC5 doing Kick Out the Jams. And then on our way out, we'll hear Deep Street Soul's version.
Fantastic.
Wayne Kramer is the author of The Hard Stuff, Dope Crime, The MC5, and My Life of Impossibilities, and he'll be out all fall on the 2018 MC50 tour. Wayne, thank you for taking all of this time, and good luck out there.
Hey, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure chatting with you and sending some shouts out to all my mainline mellows out there.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Kick out the jam. Yeah. Kick out the jam. I don't kick them out.